home. It was his skill, his skull. It would make better sense if he were, perhaps, doing things to make the building look worse to the people interested in buying it. But these little problems were not going to do that. So, most of these problems, you've seen them before?
Yeah, sure. All but those guys disappearing and the cameras not working when it happened. That is truly an odd one. And, he frowned, I haven't seen a leak like the one I found, either. That wasn't an accident. So you know. Seems like it might be a pattern.
Happens to me all the time. Listen, will you show me the records for all your employees, including their references when you hired them?
Yes, I'm curious myself.
Jen put her pad on his desk, and he transferred some files into it. As he was finishing, a young man looked in his doorway. Franklin Garr, a resident.
Hey, can you get my Zoomer down pronto, please?
6'1", dishwater blonde, good-looking in a bland way, like a model in a cheap men's clothing catalog. Eyebrows bunched as he drove home his request to Vlade. Smart, quick, nervy. Cocksure, but maybe a little rattled, too.
On its way, Vlade said heavily, toggling his boathouse dashboard.
A little motorboat with hydrofoils descended out of the murk of the boathouse rafters, and the young man threw a thanks over his shoulder as he rushed out to it.
One of your favorite residents, Jen guessed.
Vlade smiled. He can be a jerk. Impatient youth, that's for sure.
After that, she could either go to the dining hall and commons, or to her apartment, or keep working. So she kept working. She hoofed over to the Vapo dock next to the Flatiron and took the 5th south down to the Washington Square Bacino, where she knew that the Lower Manhattan Mutual Aid Society was having its monthly. Lots of building supers would be there, and various obliged and interested parties from the buildings and organizations that altogether made Lame Ass a lively place. They met on a big roof terrace that NYU provided for the meetings, a kind of cocktail hour before the evening meetings. Jen was a well-known figure, and lots of friends and acquaintances came up to greet her. It had been a while since she had made one of the monthlies. She was friendly to all, but kept an eye out for her particular friends, the supers and security experts she called her Bacino Irregulars. Clifford Sampson, an old friend of her father's from the Woolworth building, Bao Li from the Chinatown security detail, Alejandra from the James Walker Bacino Association. All these people were well known to her, and with each of them, she could give them a certain look, and they would follow her aside, ready to answer questions. She quickly ran through them. Any buildings getting sabotaged? Any unsolicited offers to buy communal buildings? Anything unusual or untoward in their employees disappearing without quitting, messing around with security systems? Yes, they all said. Yes, yes, yes. Right in my own basement, fucking with my structural integrity, cameras not seeing things. You should talk to Johan. You should talk to Luisa. In all of them, a tight Rus rage at the ugly cynicism of whoever or whatever it was, doing these things. Gentrification, my ass. Fucking slimeballs just want what we got. We got the Super Venice humming, and they want a horn in. We're going to have to hang together to keep what we've got. Time for your goddamn NYPD to show us which side they're on.
I know, Jen kept saying. I know.
NYPD is on New York's side. You know that. Nobody on the force likes those uptown creeps. Uptown is uptown. Downtown is downtown. Gotta make sure there's a balance kept. Rule of law. I need the Bacino Irregulars to jump into action, people. This, she said to a group of old friends, people who knew her from Mesrose and Hoboken, the old guard, children of the hard years after the second pulse had wrecked everything. People who were paid in food and block necklaces. People indentured to their buildings by money and love. They were gathered in a corner, and happy at the little reunion she had convened, drinking beer and swapping stories. The meetings later would be contentious, as always, people complaining, arguing, shouting, calling for votes on this and that. The crazy messiness of intertidal life. For now, they were a functioning in-group in that madness. There were probably 20 such meetings going on now all around Washington Square Bacino, prepping for the more public meetings, or just letting off steam among people they trusted. "We're all going to need the Bacino Irregulars," she said to them. "I have a task force working on this now, and my own building, my folks' building, is in the crosshairs with you. So start trolling, and let me know what you find out." "What's the angle?" they asked. "The choke point, the place to look." "See if Morningside Realty pops up," she suggested. "They're the broker for this offer on the Met Tower. If they're brokering more like that, I'd like to know. That might tug all the leads together. Also, Pincher Pinkerton. Keep an eye out for them. They're trouble right now." She stayed for the meetings, but quickly grew tired. There was a reason they called it lame ass. Lemas, that was some kind of bread. Also the name of their local currency, issued in block necklaces. But lame ass was usually how it went. Everybody had to have their say. No doubt this was right, but damn, how people went on. She could see why Vlade and Charlotte didn't make many of these meetings. End of a long day. Go over and help run the whole wet zone as a town hall meeting. Robert's rules of order or whatnot. Painful. Then again, the alternative was worse. So the lawyerly and conscientious, the young or argumentative or stubborn, kept meeting and making the effort. Hang together or hang separately. The great American realization. A Ben Franklin pun, young Franklin Garr had recently informed her with a look of amused pride. She finally stood when the meeting was over, and lots of people grabbed hold of her, many of them strangers. They liked having her there. They were the same as the Submariners. It was nice to have some manifestation of the Force on hand and paying attention, even if she had been falling asleep in her chair. Now they needed her at the dance. "Ah, God," she protested. But they dragged her along, and a punk power band with a gaggle of vocalists was firing through Lou Reed's Heroin like it was the national anthem, which, down here, maybe it was. And Jen wanted to object that the drug being celebrated was more likely to create a flow state than this supercharged nails-on-blackboard style they were indulging in. But what did she know, really? They made her dance to it, and she did. It was still just the jitterbug, shimmying with gusto, bouncing big men into the walls with her butt, ignoring her sore dogs. You could ignite a dance floor if you let the spirit come down. And God, do they need it. Afterward, someone gave her a ride home in a gondola. She would fall asleep the moment her head hit the pillow. Just like she liked it.
Lorca was on Wall Street on Black Tuesday in 1929 and saw many financiers dive out of skyscraper windows and kill themselves. One almost hit him. Later, he said it was easy for him to imagine the destruction of Lower Manhattan by hurricanes of gold. Bert Savoy was struck by lightning after talking back to a thunderstorm on the Coney Island boardwalk. "That'll be enough out of you, Miss God," he said, right before he was hit. Henry Ford was afraid that the amount of dirt that was being removed to make room for the foundation of the Empire State Building was so great that it would have a disastrous effect on the rotation of the Earth. Not a genius.
G. Franklin. Well, fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. It isn't fair. It isn't right. She lied to me. Or so I told myself. She told me she was a trader in a hedge fund, so we were doing the same job, had the same interests, shared common concerns and goals. So I fell for her. I most certainly did. And it wasn't just because she was so good-looking, even though she was. It was because of her manner, her talk, and indeed those interests we shared. We were soulmates as well as bedmates, or I should say cockpit mates, and the former made the latter out of this world. I had never felt like that before. I was in love, yes. So fuck me. I had been a fool. But I still wanted her. The thing is, working for a hedge fund, that's about making money no matter which way the market moves, no matter what happens. God declares judgment day, you're hedged. Okay, you'd have to trust God to pay out as being the final source of value, but any conceivable scenario less apocalyptic than that, you're covered, and you're going to make a profit, or at least you're going to lose less than the rest of the players, which is the same as making a profit, because it's all about differential advantage. If everyone's losing and you're losing less badly than the others, you're winning. That's hedging, and that's what hedge funds do. Jojo worked for one of the biggest hedge funds in New York. I worked for a big hedge fund. We were a match made in Black Skull's heaven. But not. Because in many hedge funds, the effort to maximize profit had led to activities additional to trading, per se, including venture capital. But venture capital makes liquid assets go illiquid, a cardinal sin in most finance. Liquidity is crucial, a fundamental value. It's the hyphens in MCM. Venture capital is therefore small potatoes in most hedge funds, and VC people usually end up talking about value-added investing, suggesting that they aim to bring in expertise that will help whomever they are investing to succeed at whatever they're doing. This is mostly bullshit, a flimsy excuse for the outrageous illiquidity of their investments, but there's no denying that a lot of them cherish the delusion. And this, I feared, was the rabbit hole Jojo had dropped into. That she wanted to do more than make money. That she wanted to make some kind of value-added investment in the so-called real economy was worrisome. El Dorado was almost certainly leveraged 100 times beyond their assets on hand, so illiquidity made them vulnerable. VC was super longing, and thus dangerous, because there was no such thing as super shorting to balance it. This suggested Jojo had gotten emotionally overinvested in a small part of her company's business, which was dangerous in itself, and indicated that her eye had strayed, that she somehow wanted more than what finance could give her, while nevertheless staying in finance. So there was delusion and pretentiousness and aspiration and lack of focus there that I didn't like to see. But now, damned if I hadn't gone super long on Jojo herself, in essence making the same kind of mistake, lost liquidity, desire for equilibrium, dislike of volatility, attachment to a particular static situation which even the Buddha warns against. And in that very dangerous situation, my intended partner in the mutual project of coupledom, which was also a kind of venturing of capital, had not hit the strike price. She had walked on her option. Actually, these financial metaphors are making me sick, while also continuing to pop up in my head in a way I seemed unable to stop. No, just stop. I liked her. I wanted her. She didn't want me. That was what it really was. So, to get her back, I needed to do things that would make her like me. Put it like that. Just start from scratch, that's all. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Well, clearly I had to keep being friendly. I had to pretend to Jojo that I was okay with us moving back to the level of a friendship of two people who lived in the same neighborhood and worked in the same industry, and saw each other in a group of mutual acquaintances after work. That was going to be tough, but I could do it. Then beyond that, I needed to find a means to reverse the usual way of the world. Instead of financializing value, I needed to add value to finance. That was at first beyond me to conceptualize. How could you add more value to finance when finance existed to financialize value? In other words, how could it be about more than money when money was the ultimate source of value itself? A mystery. a cone to stymie one. Something I pondered almost continuously as the hours and days passed. And I began to see it in a new way as something like this. It had to mean something. Finance, or even just life. It had to mean something. And meaning had no price. It could not be priced. It was some kind of alternative form of value. One of the ways I managed to make trading on the IPPI work so well for me was by keeping close track of the real intertidal. Of course, I could only really do that in New York, as it took site visits to do it. But whatever was happening in New York was pretty similar to what was going on in the other great coastal cities of the world, in particular Hong Kong, Shanghai, Sydney, London, Miami, and Jakarta. The same forces were at play in all these places, mainly aquatic stress, technological improvements, and legal issues. Whether the buildings were going to stand or collapse was one of the crucial questions, maybe the crucial question. It was a different story for each building. Although big data sets could be gathered and algorithms created to judge the risk pretty well in various categories, it was in individual cases where it got most speculative. As always, it was safest to generalize and play the percentages. But to research this question in person, I could get in the Jesus bug and zip around New York Harbor looking at actual buildings, see how they were doing, rate them against the algorithms that were predicting how they were supposed to do, and look for discrepancies that would allow me to play those spreads better than other traders. Real-world inputs to the models, thus getting a leg up on the competition, especially on the many traders who traded in coastal futures from Denver. Real-world inputs were an advantage. I was sure of this because I'd been doing it for 4 years, and it had worked. What I was seeing, to the point of confirming it to my own satisfaction, was that the models for coastal property behavior, my own included, were simply wrong about certain categories of building, something I was hesitant even to think at first, in case I somehow lost the encryption on my own thoughts, for instance by blurting something after hours in a bar. So, pondering all these things as I zipped around the waterways of the lunatic city, it seemed to me that I might already have a way to do value-added investing by putting a little venture capital where it would serve a social good, thus encouraging Jojo to reconsider me in some fundamental human sense. I could perhaps identify buildings that were more likely to collapse than the models had them collapsing on average, and figure out ways to upgrade them, putting off their collapse long enough that they could serve as refugee dwellings or maker spaces. Housing of any kind was scarce, because too many people kept coming to New York and trying to live here out of some kind of addiction, some compulsion to live like water rats when they could have done better elsewhere. Same as it ever was. Which meant there was need for some kind of Jane Jacobs-like housing reform. This was more than I could handle, but some improvements in the intertidal, that I could try. The intertidal was my specialty, so that was where I could start, try to figure something out. So I abandoned my screens one morning and went down to my sweet skimmer and hummed out of the building onto 23rd and headed west to the Hudson. Time to go out and put my eyeball to reality. The intertidal zone of lower Midtown sloshed back and forth over an area with a lot of old landfill, and that double whammy had brought a lot of buildings down. 30th to Canal was a wilderness of slumped, tilted, cracked, and collapsed blocks. A house built on sand cannot stand. Nevertheless, I saw the usual signs of squatting in the soggy ruins. Life there possibly resembled earlier centuries of cheap, squalid tenement reality, moldier than ever, the occupants risking their lives by the hour. Same as ever, but wetter. But even in the worst neighborhoods, there stood some islands of success, waterproofed and pumped out and made habitable again, in many cases better than ever, or so people claimed. The mutual aid societies were making something interesting, the so-called Super Venice, fashionably hip, artistic, sexy, a new urban legend. Some people were happy to live on the water if it was conceptualized as Venetian, enduring the mold and hassle to live in a work of art. I liked it myself. As always, each neighborhood was a little world, with a particular character. Some of them looked fine, others were bedraggled, still others abandoned. It wasn't always clear why any given neighborhood should look the way it did. Things happened. A building held or fell down. Its surroundings followed. Very contingent, very volatile, very high risk. So on this day, I hummed in very slowly to have a look at Mr. Hexter's old neighborhood, south of the Fallen Tower. It was south of the Hudson Yards, I noticed, a small bay that had lost the railroad tracks that used to floor it, leaving the shallows there open to tidal tear so severe that it was said to be as deep there as in the middle of the river. Whether seepage from that hole in the side of the island had caused this tower to fall was unknown, but there it was, its broken upper half taking waves right in its broken windows. It looked like a crippled cruise ship on its last slide to the bottom. A lot of other buildings were following it down. I was reminded of those photos of drunken forests in the Arctic, where melting permafrost had caused trees to tilt this way and that. Chelsea houses, Penn South houses, London Terrace houses, they all canted drunkenly. Not the slightest bit inspiring in terms of investment opportunities. Recovery techniques were improving all the time, but there is no point to waterproofing a house built on sand. The graphenated composites and diamond sheeting are strong, but they can't hold slumping concrete. They're more like very strong plastic wrap. They need support to work. They're mostly waterproofing. As I purred along the narrow canals between 10th and 11th, I caught sight of the great intilt quad up near the shore of the Hudson. Here in the first rush of Skybridge building, a group of investors had suspended a mall about 40 stories above the ground, in the middle of four skyscrapers that anchored the sky bridges holding the mall in air. This had thrilled people until the weight of the mall had pulled the four towers abruptly inward, dropping the mall five stories at once and breaking everything in it before somehow the towers held. After that, people had gotten a lot more careful. And now the great intilt quad stood there like a bad Stonehenge, reminding people never to hang too much weight outside the plumb line of a skyscraper. They were only built to hold up their own weight, as many engineers pointed out. All these drunken buildings, how long could they last? In the eternal battle of men against the sea, which antagonist was winning? The sea was always the same. While improvements were being made in humanity's ramparts, but the sea was relentless. And it might rise yet again. A third pulse was not out of the question, although big masses of ice at risk of sliding were not currently being identified by the Antarctic surveys. This was a finding factored into the IPPI. Anyway, wherever sea level went in years to come, the intertidal was always going to be in trouble. Anyone who tried on a regular professional basis to fight the sea in any capacity whatsoever always admitted that the sea always won in the end, that its victory was merely a matter of time. Some of them could get quite philosophical about this in a depressive, nihilist way. Nothing we do matters. We work like dogs, and then we die, etc. So a time was going to come when all the weaker buildings in the intertidal were going to need major repair, if that was even possible. If it wasn't, they would have to be replaced, if that could even be done. Meanwhile, people were living here. Signs of squatting were everywhere. Broken windows replaced, laundry hanging from clotheslines, farms on rooftops. Especially by day, it was obvious. At night, they would turn off their lights, and their buildings would look abandoned, perhaps here or there candle lit for their ghosts' convenience. But by day, it was easy to see. And of course, it would always be that way. Manhattan never had enough places to live, and you couldn't make rents high enough to keep people away, because they dodged the rents and squatted wherever they could. The drowned city had endless nooks and crannies, including, of course, diamond bubbles holding the tide out of aerated basements. People living like rats. This was probably what JoJo was hoping to ameliorate with her value-added investing. It was hopeless, really. Even if you managed to do it, it would make you a kind of topologically reversed Sisyphus, digging a hole that always refilled, pumping out basement after basement only to have them pop, often lethally, then back to it again. Aeration. Submarine real estate. A new market to finance and then to leverage so that the cycle could repeat at a larger scale, as the first law demanded. Always grow. This meant that once the island surface was filled to the max, you first shot up into the sky. Then when that effort reached the limit of the material strengths of the time, you had to dive. After the basements and subways and tunnels were aerated, no doubt people would start carving caves deeper and deeper, extending an invisible Calvinosity down into the lithosphere, excavating earth scrapers to match the skyscrapers, buildings right down to the center of the earth. Geothermal heating available at no extra charge. Apartments in hell. And that was Manhattan. Except not really. One could think pessimistically when boating about in the abandoned ruins of Chelsea, trying not to look back at the furtive faces in top-floor windows and yet seeing the misery there anyway. But it was easy to clear one's head of these dreary visions. Just turn the bug and hum out of the Great River and throttle up to hydroplane speed, lift off and fly. Fly upstream and away, away from the wounded city. Fly! I did that. The broad Hudson sheeted under me, its internal movements coiling and fracturing the dark surface. And there it was, standing around me on both sides of the river, Upper Manhattan and Hoboken, both of them studded with skyscrapers taller than anywhere else, the two sides of the river competing for dominance by prominence. Right in a decade when the revolution in building materials had allowed the construction of skyscrapers three times taller than ever before. And it still pleased the rich to stash away a billion or three in a sky apartment somewhere in New York, visit for a few days a year, enjoy the great city of the world. No way Denver was ever going to match the view I was looking at right now. I let the bug down onto the water with a ducky splash and headed into the long dock floating under the cloister cluster. The great complex of super towers, each well over 300 stories tall, loomed overhead like the visible part of a space elevator. It truly looked as if they pierced the blue dome of the sky, that they disappeared up there without actually ending. This effect made the sky itself seem somehow lower than usual, like a turquoise blue dome in some immense circus, held up by a four-pronged center pole. There was a line at the marina entry almost a dozen boats long, so I pulled up next to the cliffside that rose so steeply out of the river along this part of the island, to wait for the line to clear. The old Henry Hudson Parkway had been submerged by the river long ago, and the hack they had made in the hillside to hold that Robert Moses intervention was now underwater even at low tide, and home to a narrow long salt marsh, a flowing yellow-green surface carpeting the foot of the hillside, which was covered with brush and ferns and small trees, and studded with the island's bossy nice outcroppings protruding out of the greenery. I hummed slowly into the grass edging the salt marsh and turned upstream. Felt the bug's starboard hydrofoil touch the bottom. It was near high tide. A quiet estuarine corner of the city. A little Thoreau theater, cool in the shade of a passing cloud. The grass of the marsh was almost entirely submerged at this point of the tide. Some kind of fluid eelgrass, flowing horizontally this way and that, pushed first downstream by the river's flow, then upstream in the repeated slosh of boat wakes. The many grass stalks flowed in parallel, like hair underwater in a bathtub. Each green stalk had yellow chips cross-hatching it, and as the flat mass angel-haired back and forth in the waves, there was a lovely, mesmerizing sparkle of gold in the green. Back and forth, the flowing grass flexed, sparkly and fluid. Back and forth, green and gold, back and forth, flow, flow, flow. Really very pretty. And in that moment, watching this motion, just passing the time in a little contemplation of the river's verge, waiting for the boats to clear the marina entry, I experienced a vision, a satori, an epiphany, and if you had told me flames were shooting out of the top of my head at that moment, I would not have been surprised to hear it. The biblically boggled ones had only been accurately describing the feel of when such an idea lances you. Luckily, there was no one there to hear me speaking in tongues or to interrupt my thought and cause me to forget the whole thing. No, I had it. I thought it through. I felt it. I wasn't going to forget it. I watched the grass flow back and forth in the stream, fixing the thought with the mesmerizing image over the side of the bug. Really quite beautiful. "Hey, thanks," I said to the dock master as he waved me into the marina. "I just had an idea."
"Congratulations."
I strode up the enormous broad stairs to the plaza that surrounded the Cloister Monster, the biggest tower in the cluster of four great super towers that launched out of the hilltop. The Monster was built in the shape of a barice column, meaning the bottom and top of the building were both semicircular, but with the semicircles oriented 180 degrees to each other. This configuration made all the exterior surfaces of the building curve very gracefully. The other towers of the cluster were also barice columns, but with two for each tower, stacked vertically such that their midpoints formed matching semicircles. This arrangement doubled down on the lovely long curves rising up to puncture the sky. I crossed to the plaza with my head canted back like a tourist, enjoying the architectural sublime, which at this point in my day of the idea was gilding the lily, but in a good way. Everything seemed vast. Inside the Monster, I took the sequence of ear-popping express elevators to floor 301, the top floor, where Hector Ramirez had his office, if that was the word for a room that occupied an entire floor of a building that big. A loft? It was a single semicircular space about the size of Block Island, glass-walled on all sides.
"Franklin Garr."
"Maestro, thanks for seeing me."
"My pleasure, youth."
He had not spoiled the impact of his perch with much in the way of furniture. Around the elevator core, there were some chest-high cubicles and some desks outside those, but beyond that lay an open space that extended to curving window walls to the south, flat glass to the north, the glass in every direction so clean it was hard to be sure it was even there. One saw the world. To the south, the rest of uptown was a forest of superscrapers only a bit shorter than the Cloister cluster, each displaying its particular Gary glory. To the left of these towers lay the Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn, all three boroughs now bays studded with buildings, with Brooklyn Heights the first real land to be seen that way, topped by its own line of superscrapers. It was only from this distance one could see how tall the new towers really were, which was really very tall. Meanwhile, water gleamed everywhere, filled with drowned buildings and bridges, ships and ships' wakes. Same to the right, but the Hudson was a cleaner, broader sweep of water than the East River and its shallows. A great blue sea road, crowded with watercraft but clean of ruined rooftops, with only the George Washington and Verrazano bridges crossing the Great Bay. Hoboken formed another dragon-back horizon, cutting off the view of the immense bay filling the meadowlands, punctuated at its south end by the fat towers topping Staten Island. To the north lay the north, a haze cut by the great river. The north was the place to get away to, but no one wanted to go. If you were really going to leave the city, you would go up. And in fact, above this office, I knew Hector's airship was tethered, a small sky village of the 21 balloons type. He could leave for heaven any time he wanted, and occasionally he did. Now he seemed to be happy to see me, and I was definitely happy to see him, boss, teacher, mentor, advisor. I had had several of each of these through the years, but Hector had been the first who combined all these roles, and so had become the most important of any of them. I had interned for him when I was too young to know how lucky I was, right out of Harvard's lame business school, and he had taught me many things, but most usefully the art of swaps on social policy bonds. I had been working out evolutions of those lessons ever since, and now they were going to be crucial to surviving the intertidal meltdown. "Push is coming to shove," I said, pointing down the length of the Aquatropolis. Midtown blocked our view of downtown, but he knew what I meant, and the immense sweep of the Hudson stood well for the coming fate of Lower Manhattan. It was going to look like that. "I thought recovery tech was getting stronger," Hector said, to show that he knew what I was referring to. "It is," I granted, "but not fast enough. Mother Ocean can't be beat, and it's turning out to be toughest to fight her in the intertidal. Tide after tide, wave after wave, nothing can stand against that. Not over the long haul."
"So it's made sense to short it," he noted.
"Yes, as we know. But I've been thinking about what comes after."
"Retreat to higher ground?"
He gestured around him.
"Sure.
Path of least resistance, off to Denver. But some places will be different, and this is going to be one of them. It's the myth of the place. People just won't stop coming. It doesn't matter that it's a fatal shore. They want it." He was nodding. He had come here from Venezuela, he had told me, feeling the pull himself. Water rat, dime in his pocket. Now here.
"And so?"
"So, there's a combination of new techs that add up to what you might call eelgrass housing. Some of it comes from aquaculture. Basically, you stop trying to resist. You flex with the currents. You rise and fall on the tides. You take graphene's strength and new glue's stickiness and faux fascia's flexibility. You put bollards in the bedrock, however deep that is, and anchor them to the bands of fascia cord that would stretch with the tides and would always be long enough to reach the surface, where you attach a floating platform. You make the platform the size of your ordinary Manhattan block."
"So it would be like living on a dock or a houseboat?"
"Yes, and some of it can lie underwater, like in the hull of a ship. Then you link all the platforms so that they move together in the tides, like eelgrass. Side bumpers where necessary, like boats have where their sides hit a dock. Eventually you'd have a floating mat of these platforms, a whole neighborhood of them."
"You couldn't go very high."
"I'm not so sure. The graphenated composites are really light. That's what has us up here so high. Anyway, it could go at least as high as it was before in that part of town." He nodded.
"Can it be done?"
"All the tech is already available, and pretty soon all the stock down there is going to fall in the drink." He was nodding still.
"Go along, my son. Go along."
"I am. I will."
"So what do you want from me?"
"Leverage. I want an angel." He laughed.
"All right. I've been wondering what would come next in this town. It sounds very exciting. Count me in."
So that was good. Really good. And I was still thinking hard about it as I put the bug back out in the river and let it drift downstream back to Midtown. The problem that remained, in the here and now, was that I worked on derivatives in a hedge fund, and not in an architectural firm designing the next iteration of intertidal design. I couldn't do that work from my position, but I could fund it. That meant finding people to fund. Of course, this resembled what I was already doing every day, because finding something to fund was very similar to finding a good bet. Even though Water Price didn't have much of a VC element in its portfolio, arguably it should. And finding the long to follow the coming short was wise for anyone. It was kind of like what I was trying to do with JoJo. That got me wondering if I could let her know what I was up to, or even ask her for help with it, whatever might impress her more. If that was what this was all for, which it was, at least primarily. But then it might be a case of the sooner the better, and asking for help a sign of mature vulnerability. I had the feeling she would like it, and I was impatient to tell her about it too. So when the bug had drifted down to Midtown, I put in at Pier 57 and went to the bar where we had first met. It was a Friday again, just before sunset, and again there she was, regular as clockwork. What was with that? There was the same group, John and Yevgenia and Ray and Amanda, and they all greeted me in a friendly way, JoJo too, as if nothing had transpired between us. Then again, Amanda and I were that way with each other, so it couldn't be said that it was all that unusual for JoJo to be acting like this, cool and friendly, uninvolved. Dang. Well, I got a drink from Inky, who was asking me questions about this very problem with his eyes, but I just rolled mine, to indicate all was less than well, and I would tell him about it later. Then went back to the gang. On the railing at sunset in December, air chilly. The river sliding brassily over itself in its ebbing hurry down to the narrows. House band inside playing space blues, trying to soundtrack the view. The gang's talk was the same, and again I was mystified. These people, my crowd, had a tendency to be crass jerks. And yet JoJo had been all happy-happy with them the day I met her, and now too. We both fit right in. So what did that mean? I had a cold thought. Maybe she had claimed I lacked the altruism she liked in a man, just to give her a decent cover story for something more fundamental than, well, more fundamental than fundamental philosophies of life. That didn't quite compute, but then again, I didn't know. Probably it would in fact be easier to accept that she didn't like my values than my smell or my style of lovemaking, which in fact she had seemed to like. Well, it was just very confusing. I tried to ignore that whirlpool in my brain and my gut, and eventually stood by her side, and there we were. "How was your day?" she asked. "It was good," I said. "Interesting. I was talking with my old teacher from Monstrosity about trying to do something with all the fixes that people have been venting to keep real estate from going under. You know, some kind of venture capital thing. Sort of like what you were talking about before." She regarded me with some curiosity, and I tried to take hope from that, and not get distracted by the crystalline brown shatter of her eyes, the gorgeous eyes of the person I had fallen for so hard, which was nearly impossible, and I couldn't help gulping a little under her gaze. "What did you have in mind?" she asked. "Well, it occurred to me that since the intertidal doesn't have bedrock under it, you can never build anything there you can trust will hold."
"So you let them go?"
"No, in fact, I was talking with Hector about anchoring what you might call floating neighborhoods there. Connect little township-like blocks to the bedrock no matter how far down it is, and then you wouldn't be fighting the tide so much."
"Ah," she said, looking surprised. "Good idea."
"I think maybe so."
"Good idea," she said again, then frowned a little. "So you're interested in venture capital now?"
"Well, I was just thinking. There does have to be something to go long on after the short. You were right about that."
"It's true." "Well, that's interesting. Good for you."
So, a little bit of hope there, attached to a bedrock emotion, deep under the waves,
the emotion being how much I wanted her. Attach a line to that bedrock, float a little buoy of hope, come back later and see what else might be attachable. She seemed not unfriendly, not amused at my sudden interest in real estate, not anything obviously negative, maybe even friendly, maybe even approving. Thinking things over, a little smile in her eyes. One time a photographer had said to me, "Smile with your eyes only." I hadn't gotten what he meant. Maybe now I was seeing it. Maybe. The way she was looking at me, well, I couldn't tell. To be honest, I couldn't tell what she was thinking. Not at all.
When Radio City was first opened, they dosed its air with ozone, with the idea that this would make people happier. The developer, Samuel Rothafel, had wanted it to be laughing gas, but he couldn't get the city to approve it. Robin Hood Asset Management began by analyzing 20 of the most successful hedge funds and creating an algorithm that combined all their most successful strategies, then offering its services to microinvestments from the precariat, and going from there to their now famous success. The old Waldorf Astoria, demolished to make way for the Empire State Building, was dumped in the Atlantic, 5 miles off Sandy Hook. We lingered in New York till the city felt so homelike that it seemed wrong to leave it. And further, the more one studied it, the more grotesquely bad it grew. Rudyard Kipling, 1892.
H. Mutt and Jeff. Jeff, are you awake?
I don't know. Am I?
It sounds like you are. That's good.
Where are we?
We're still in that room. You've been sick.
What room?
A shipping container somewhere, where someone is keeping us. Maybe underwater. Sometimes it sounds like we're underwater.
If you're underwater, you can never get clear. The market will never come back to where it was, so you're sunk for good. Might as well default and walk away.
I would if I could, but we're locked down here.
I remember now. How you doing?
What?
I said, how are you doing?
Me? I'm fine, fine. Actually, I've been feeling too good, but nowhere near as bad as you. You were pretty sick there.
I still feel like shit.
Yeah, sorry to hear, but at least you're talking. For a while there, you weren't able to talk. That was scary.
What happened?
What happened? Oh, to you. I wrote some notes on our plates and sent them out when they got picked up out of the door slot. Then your food started to come with some pills that I got you to take. Then once I slept really hard, and I think that was because they knocked us out and came in here, or took you out. I don't know, but when I woke up again, you were sleeping more easily. And now, here we are. I feel like shit. But you're talking. But I don't want to talk. Mutt doesn't know what to say to this. He sits by his friend's bed, reaches over, and holds Jeff's hand. It's better when you talk. It's good for you.
Not really.
Jeff eyes his friend.
You talk. I'm tired of talking. I can't talk anymore.
I can't believe that.
Believe it. Tell me a story.
Who, me? I don't know any stories. You tell stories, not me.
Not anymore. Tell me about yourself.
There's nothing to tell.
Not true. Tell me how we met. I've forgotten that. It's been so long. First thing I remember, it feels like we had been together forever. I don't recall before.
Well, you were younger than me then. I do remember that, yeah. I had been at Adirondack for a year or two at that point, and I was thinking of quitting. The work was boring. Then I was in their cafeteria at lunch one day, and there you were at the end of the table, by yourself, reading your pad while you ate. I went over and sat across from you, I don't know why, and introduced myself. You looked interesting. You said you were in systems, but as we talked, I could tell you were into coding, too. I remember I asked where the rest of your team was, and you said they had already gotten sick of you and your ideas, so there you were. I said I liked your ideas, which was true at the time. That was how it started. Then we were asked to try encrypting their dark pool divers. Do you remember?
No.
That's too bad. We had a good time.
I'll remember later, maybe.
I hope so. We had a good time at work, and then, I don't know how it happened, somehow I found out that you didn't have a regular place to live. You were sleeping in your car.
Mobile home.
Yes, that's what you called it. A very small mobile home. So I was looking for a new place myself, so we moved into that place in Hoboken, remember?
Sure. How could I forget?
Well, you forgot our first job, so who knows. Anyway, there we were.
That's how we know this place is underwater, because that place was.
Maybe so. I mean, it was. Subsurface real estate was just starting in the Meadowlands, so there were some rents we could afford. So that was when we started working on front-running that would work for us as well as for Vincent. By then, he was off on his own.
That was illegal. He was always an asshole.
Yes, that too. So we felt like we were just gigging for him doing questionable shit. Presumably, if the SEC had ever twigged it, we would have been the ones to take the fall. People at Albin would have disavowed all knowledge of our existence.
Of a mission all too possible.
Yes, it was easy. But then we found out that everyone else was already doing it, so we were a late entry into an arms race no one could win. There was no difference between front-running and ordinary trading. So we quit Albin before we got hung out to dry. Started gigging around. It got a little ragged then. We needed something different if we wanted an advantage.
Did we want an advantage?
I don't know. All our clients did.
Not the same.
I know.
I don't want to work for them anymore.
I know. But that's led to problems for us, as you know.
As in?
Well, food. Food and lodging. We need those, and they take money. And you have to work to make money.
I'm not saying don't work. I'm saying not for them.
Agreed. We already tried that.
We have to work for ourselves.
Well, that's what they do, too. I mean, we'd likely end up just like them.
For everybody, then. Work for everybody.
Mutt nods, looking pleased. He's gotten his friend talking again. Possibly the pills have helped, possibly the tide has turned, and they are past the deep ebb in his health. But how? Mutt asks, nudging the tide. But you can't push the river.
How should I know? That's what I tried, and look where it got us. I tried to just do it direct, but I'm the idea man, and you're the facilitator. Isn't that how it usually worked with us? I would have a crazy idea, and you would figure out how to implement it?
I don't know about that.
Sure you do. So look, I had some fixes. I tried to tap into the system and make the fixes directly. Maybe it was stupid.
Okay, it was stupid. It got us here, I'm guessing. And they could always just change the fixes back again anyway. So it was never going to work.
I guess I was a little crazy then.
Mutt sighs.
I know, Jeff says. But tell me how. Tell me how we could do it. Because we're not the only ones who need these fixes. Everyone needs them.
Mutt doesn't know what to say. But on the other hand, he has to say something to keep Jeff going. So he says, Jeff, these are laws you're talking about here. They aren't just fixes. They're like new laws. So laws are made by lawmakers. We elect them. But, you know, companies pay for their campaigns, so they say they're going to work for us, but once in office, they work for the companies. It's been that way a long time. Of the companies, buy tools for the companies.
But what about the people?
You can either believe that voting lawmakers into office means they work for you, so you keep voting, or you can admit that doesn't work and quit voting, which doesn't work either.
So okay, that's why I tried to jam the fixes in there as a hack.
I know.
Tell me how we can do it better.
I'm thinking. I guess I'd say we have to try a one-time takeover of the existing legislative bodies and pass a bunch of laws that put people back in charge.
One-time takeover? Isn't that like revolution? Are you saying we need a revolution?
Well, no.
No? It sounds to me like yes. But no. I mean, yes and no. Thank you for that. Such clarity. What I mean is, if you use the currently existing legal system to vote in a group of congresspeople who actually pass laws to put people back in charge of lawmaking, and they do it, and there's a president who signs those laws, and a Supreme Court that allows they are legal, and an army that enforces them, then... I mean, is that a revolution? Jeff is silent for a long time. Finally, he says, yes, it's a revolution. But it's legal. All the better, right? Sure, granted. But so then, how do you get that Congress and president elected? Politics, I guess. You tell the better story and run the candidates who will do what you say. They would have to be Democrats, because third parties always lose. They screw the party closest to them. That's the American way. Okay, even better. Already existing party. Just win. So it's just politics, you're telling me? I guess so. Jeez, no wonder I tried to hack the system, because your solution totally sucks. Well, at least it's legal. If it worked, it would work. Thank you for that wisdom. I am wondering now if all the great wisdom is as tautological as that. I fear maybe so. But no. No, Mutnick. You need to think again. This solution of yours is no solution at all. I mean, people have been trying it for 300 years, whatever, and it has only gotten worse and worse. There have been ups and downs. There has been progress. And here we are. Okay, granted, here we are. So come up with something new. I'm trying. Again, Jeff is silent. He's had to exert himself to talk this much. It's been more than he has in him to give. And now he's looking exhausted, weary to the bone, sick to death of seeing what he is seeing in his vision of the world. After a while, Mutt asks, Jeff, are you awake? After a while, Jeff rouses. Don't know. I'm really tired. Hungry? Don't know. I have some crackers here. No. Long pause. Possibly Jeff is weeping here. Weeping, or sleeping, or both. Finally, he rouses himself, makes an effort. Tell me a story. I told you to tell me a story.
I thought I was.
Tell me a story I can believe. That's harder, but okay. Well, once upon a time, there was a country across the sea where everyone tried their best to make a community that worked for everyone. Utopia? New York. Everyone was equal there. Men, women, children, and people you couldn't even say what they were. All the various skin tones, and wherever you came from before, it didn't matter. In this new place, you made it all new. And people were just people, meant to be equal, and to treat each other respectfully at all times. It was a good place. Everyone liked living there. And they saw it was a beautiful place to begin with. Incredible, really. The harbor, and from east to west, it was just one beautiful place after another, with animals and fish and birds in such profusion that sometimes when flocks of birds flew overhead, they darkened the day. You couldn't see the sun or the sky. It was so full of birds. When the fish came back up the rivers to spawn, you could walk across the streams on their backs. That kind of thing. The animals ran in the millions. There was a forest that covered everything. Lakes and rivers to die for. Mountains you couldn't believe. It was a gift to have such a land given to you. Why didn't anyone live there before? Jeff asks from out of his sleep. Well, that's another story. Actually, there were people there already, I have to say. But alas, they didn't have immunity to the diseases that the new people brought with them, so most of them died. But the survivors joined this community and taught the newcomers how to take care of the land so that it would stay healthy forever. That's the story I'm telling you now. It took knowing every rock and plant and animal and fish and bird. That was the way they did it. You had to love the land the way you loved your mother.
or in case you didn't love your mother the way you loved your child or yourself. Because it was you anyway. It took knowing all the other parts of yourself so well that nothing was misunderstood or exploited, and everything was treated respectfully.